Steve, also for your assistance. It's a pleasure to having you here. And so Steve Fuller is teaching sociology at Warwick. And I will simply say that your last book is Humanity 2.0. And apparently your talk today is going to link the problem, the classic problem generation, okay, imagine that time, with the problem of aging and dying. So.
Okay.
You're going to talk 40 minutes.
T-minus 40 minutes, so we have at least, so we have 20 minutes for discussion. First of all, thank you for inviting me. And I guess looking at this room, I might be the second or third oldest person in the room. I think that might be of some significance. I have to say that when I was... invited to participate in this conference, I guess I took the remit of this conference to be somewhat broader than it turned out to be. So in other words, I took aging and dying as separate issues, not one leading to the other. and I think in a sense, the way we've been discussing matters is sort of like aging is in some sense on the road to dying. And I actually see the issue of dying and aging as quite separate issues. It raises a quite different set of philosophical issues and so forth. And the point that that you raised at the in the introduction about the role of generations is quite important. So where are you, you know, in history with regard to certain kinds of important events and so forth? And in that respect, I thought that... that would come to the fore more. And also the idea that dying isn't just something for the old. The young can get into it too. Okay? And so it seems to me that... So this is why I think aging and dying are really mutually separate issues, right? They do overlap to a certain extent in certain areas, and I think this conference has been largely devoted to that, but they are separate issues. Okay, that's how I came to this. And as you also mentioned in your introduction, I've recently published a book called Humanity 2.0, which has to do with issues, you know, you may know about transhumanism and things of this kind, where there is a whole lot of discussion about living forever and all the rest of it, but transhumanism doesn't necessarily have to be understood in that sort of strict sense of the human body as we now have it going on indefinitely, but it could involve issues of the transmigration or resurrection or moving into a different bodily medium where by traditional notions one might think of dying and then being reborn. Okay? So it seems to me that there's a whole broader range of issues here that in a sense weren't touched on by this conference, and insofar as we are interested in aging and dying, there's a lot more to talk about, and I can't pretend to be able to talk about this in the amount of time I've got, but I want to just flag some issues that come from various directions. Now, the first issue that comes from my original training's in history and philosophy of science, in case you're not familiar with my work, but I've been professor of sociology in the UK for many years now. And within sociology, there is a discussion of generations, right? Of the concept of generations and what that means. And this discussion is normally associated with the founder of the sociology of knowledge, Karl Mannheim. Okay, so Karl Mannheim wrote a famous essay in the 1920s, in many respects reflecting upon the experience of Weimar Germany. And the rise of, so we have Weimar Germany is the first time you actually have a constitutional democracy in Germany, and you get a proliferation of political parties, and the political parties in a way define themselves in terms of how they stand with respect to very important dates in the history of Germany. Okay, and Mannheim, if you're not familiar with Mannheim's work, Mannheim's sociology of knowledge basically centers on a kind of theory of ideology, where ideology is tied very much to whether one is past or future oriented, right? And the future orientation is the sort of utopian vision, which to a large extent he actually shared. But this is kind of the context in which we're operating. And so there's one sense in which one might think about generation in terms, and this is the way Mannheim tended to talk about it, in terms of where you were at key moments in history. Okay, so where were you in 1870 when Germany formed? Right, was this part of your formative experience of what Germany is? Right, and those people who by the 1920s would have been quite old, right, for them there is this kind of sense of, you know, Germany coming into its own and then suffering a kind of humiliation as a result of World War I. But if you're someone who didn't fight in the war and don't really have a clear relationship to the war, and let's say born in the early 20th century, right, then there's a sense in which that is somebody else's problem, that is not your problem. Okay, and so though that generation perhaps tended to be more kind of open to other possibilities and not really trying to recover a past, in a sense, you know, one felt could be left behind. Okay, and so Mannheim was basically trying to talk about how generations, in a way, mark themselves in terms of their relationship to key moments in history. Now, that's not actually the way in which we talk about generations in sociology these days. I mean, Mannheim has a very distinctive kind of way of looking at the issue, which I think is very instructive. And I think, for example, in our own time, I think Mannheim's way of looking at things helps to explain attitudes toward technological progress. And I'll give you a case in point. So I'm 53 years old. Okay, and that's why I said I thought I was maybe the second or third oldest person in the room. And people who are about my age often make a big deal these days about how we have not lived, we have not really fulfilled our technological promise, where the benchmark moment is the landing on the moon. Okay, so that's 1969, you have the landing on the moon. And why haven't we done more? And even though we've had a lot of progress with regard to computers and so forth, the sort of promise that was really made very clear in the 1960s doesn't seem to have gone forward. And I do find it's very common that the sort of people who complain about this tend to be people who are between their mid-40s and mid-50s, okay? There's a science fiction author who's gotten a lot of attention in the United States for making this point. Neal Stephenson, I don't know if some of you who follow science fiction may know of his work. He's someone in this vein. And so that's, in a sense, how you position yourself with regard to a particular event in history, where you sort of say, we sort of expected that the future would be kind of like what things were like in our childhood when things were going really well. Okay, now you, if you're a younger person and you live in the postmodern condition that Claudia was talking about, for example, you might think that's just nostalgia. Right? That's just nostalgia, that you want to go back to this period, you know, where you sort of indefinitely, the world would become the 1960s extended. Okay? But if you're someone who was born, let's say, in the 1970s or 1980s, right, you have a different sort of sense of the future. You might be into the, you know, and you might be kind of open to, you might have a more open to anything viewpoint, where you don't expect a certain kind of progressive trajectory. You don't have a very clear sense of what's good and bad and so forth. But what you believe is that one should be kind of open. And of course, given that you've been living in a world that's been entirely neoliberal, pretty much, decline of socialism and so forth, this fits perfectly. Right, so people from the 1970s, you know, who come of age in the 1970s and 80s, they're often wondering what it was that all these socialist, modernist, progressivists were all about. Okay, and so they see something like the moon landing in 1969 as kind of almost like a folly, you know, in a sense. Yeah, that was a kind of one-off thing. Right, and given that the space program did decline very soon after that, right, it's an easy thing to sort of historically document that interpretation. Okay, so this is the kind of thing that Mannheim was getting at in terms of how you position yourself with regard to historical events, and how you mark off, you know, what is backward and forward looking. Okay, because somebody like Neal Stephenson, who's of my generation, would say, to continue the progress thing, we've got to rededicate ourselves to more technological innovation. The reason why I mention him is because he's managed to convince some engineers in Arizona to build some sort of enormous skyscraper from which one could launch a rocket that would enable to gain enough propulsion so that it could travel into galaxies beyond our own. Okay, this is, you know, okay. Now, again, you see, if you're a younger person, you say, this is just nonsense, you know what? But you see, this is seen as something possible if you're of that sort of age group. And this is what Mannheim had in mind in terms of generational difference. So in Mannheim's case, one would talk about what are the possibilities for Germany in the future in the 1920s, right? Given it had this very humiliating kind of defeat in World War I, given the heavy reparations, what should Germany be doing as a result of that? And there were all these different parties having quite different attitudes. Some of the older ones wanting to reassert a certain kind of German nationalism, which of course Hitler eventually played into, but others thinking of a sort of more European, maybe we ought to be, as it were, less German in the future kind of idea, and that being the more progressive one. Okay, then that is Mannheim's view of what the whole generation difference was about. But of course now, in light of empirical work in sociology, there's a tendency to think about generations, you know, simply in terms of cohorts. In other words, we're not talking so much about how people from who are of different ages relate to a particular event, but rather people, we're just looking at, as it were, time slices of people who were born at the same time. Right, so a cohort is someone who's born at the same time, and we look at how those people together march through time. Okay, and that's the idea of a generational cohort, and typically in sociology, that's how it's studied. So it's not so much studied in terms of how people position themselves with regard to collectively defining events, but rather how do people who were born at the same time move through life together. Okay, and that's quite an important distinction, at least within sociology. And the interesting thing is most of the stuff that's done on generational research is of the cohort type, right? So you have relatively little empirical or historical research done of how people actually relate to events that might be considered pivotal, where people might want to position themselves differently. But it seems to me that, you know, if one is talking about how people are orienting themselves to the world, actually doing regular surveys of how people position themselves with regard to significant events could be a very illuminating thing, but that is not actually done. Okay, so that's one point. Now, you know, as I said in the beginning, my background's in history and philosophy of science, and one context where this issue of generational difference comes into play has a lot to do with a thesis that's associated with Thomas Kuhn. Thomas Kuhn is a figure, those of you who know my work know I'm very critical of, but one thing that he did propose that I think is not only relevant to this conference, but I think has a lot of truth to it, is he basically revived what is called the Planck thesis in the history of science. And this is the idea, effectively, that paradigms don't change because people get persuaded to the new paradigm. Paradigms change because the old guys just die, right? And that if you want a paradigm shift, you need new people, okay? And this is a position that Max Planck, one of the founders of quantum mechanics, put forward in his autobiography that was written in the late 1930s when he was already in his 70s. Okay, and it's actually that work, Planck's scientific autobiography, as it's called, is actually a very interesting work to read in terms of insights into how science works. He's a very reflective, philosophically very reflective guy, Max Planck. Whether one agrees or disagrees with him, it's a book worth reading. Kuhn clearly read the book, and the thing that's key here is that Planck believed that basically when it came to the acceptance in case you don't know, Planck was very instrumental in the legitimation of relativity theory, Einstein's theory of relativity, special relativity. He was the editor of the journal in which the original 1905 paper was published, and part of what Planck had to do was to basically how should we say, correct, refine Einstein's mathematics to make it credible for the physics community, because Einstein, as you know, was a patent officer in Bern in Switzerland at the time, and he sent the thing to Planck. Planck realized that there was something going on here that was really quite significant, but it had to be sort of sharpened up a bit for the physicists to be able to receive it properly. And so Planck was very important in that development, okay? And of course, Planck, who at that point was already in his late 40s when he was editor of the journal, right, also lived through the revolution in quantum mechanics in terms of the indeterminacy thesis in the 1920s, which Planck himself never completely endorsed, but nevertheless saw what was going on. He lived through these two revolutions in a very intimate kind of way. And his conclusion was that at the end of the day, it is really hard to convince people, especially if we're talking about the people who matter at the moment, right? The practicing professionals, the adults, the ones who are publishing the papers, those people cannot be persuaded. But of course, those aren't the only people who are reading the stuff. There are all these other younger people, people who don't have, you know, tenured professorial appointments, who aren't publishing, who are being taught, and so forth. And as it were, they do not have invested, you know, all the stuff that the older guys do, right? Because in a sense, the new people learn the established science as book learning, in a sense, right? They learn it as kind of received wisdom, but they don't learn it as something that they themselves have had to live through or really have to, you know, work with in producing their own work. So in that respect, the younger people have a kind of more open mind on the matter, right? They know they've been taught stuff, but they haven't yet had to commit much of their lives to perpetuating it. So they can take a somewhat more detached viewpoint. And so one of the things that you do see is that there is, you know, as the generations move, as the old guys retire, as new people come in, you get this gradual receptiveness, but not because any of the key players ever change their minds, but rather new people come to the fore. Okay? Now this view is very hotly contested within the philosophy of science. Philosophers, generally speaking, do not like this viewpoint because it really, there's a sense in which it has a kind of unsavory Darwinian character to this thing, right? That basically, you know, the future belongs to the survivors. And that there's no way really of convincing people or persuading people, sort of people die with their theoretical boots on. Right? You know, so they stick on their views and then they just disappear and that's the end of it. And then you get a new bunch of people who believe something different. Okay? But as a matter of fact, you know, while age, I mean, I think what the empirical work on this shows, if I can put it briefly, is that if you're an older person, it doesn't follow that you won't change your mind, but those who don't change their mind tend to be older people. Okay, and that's often quite a lot of the establishment. Right, so there are people like Max Planck, for example, who's kind of an older guy through the revolutions in both relativity and then later in the 20s with the quantum indeterminacy. Right, he's an older guy throughout this whole thing, but he kind of moves with the flow. Right, but the people who resist very strongly tend to be the older people too. Okay, and the younger people move. Right, they go from one to the other. They have no problem, as it were, especially if they haven't yet established a strong career presence in the old paradigm. They quite willingly are willing to try out other things. Okay, so there is some support for this, right? There's some support for this, at least from the standpoint of that older people do tend to be retardants. Okay, not all of them, but if you want to look at where the retardants are, it is among the older people. Okay, it's not a, so I mean, I think that's the way to look at this. Now, this raises a whole lot of issues. How much more time do I have?
20 minutes.
20 minutes, okay. Okay. Now, this raises a whole lot of issues with regard to how we think about, you know, the kind of knowledge that comes with age. Because one of the things that that didn't seem to be really stressed very much in this conference, which in a way is kind of built into, you might say, the drag paradigm shift, right, is the fact that there is perceived to be a certain kind of wisdom that comes with age, right? We have a paradigm. Let's say if you're one of the older people, if you're making the argument why we shouldn't be shifting from Newton to Einstein, right, part of what you're saying is, you know, we've got 200 years of doing physics in this way. We've done a lot this way. It works. Okay, we've got problems, but maybe we should just persist with this. There's no reason why we need to sort of change radically here, right? So there's a kind of collective kind of wisdom that comes, that the older people know very well, that they benefited from, and which they believe needs to be continued into the future. And I was very surprised to the extent to which in this conference, the epistemic character of wisdom as one of the things that follows from age has not really been flagged very much as a positive feature, okay? Because I do think, this business about the knowledge that you get from age and the value of that, okay, this intersects in a very interesting way with the points that came up, I guess in particular with Kegel's talk this morning, and that is what the value of forgetting is, okay? Because one of the things that Kuhn talks about, which I think is again a good point on his, in the philosophy of science, we talk about this thing called Kuhn loss. Kuhn loss is basically the kind of knowledge that sort of disappears when the paradigm changes. Okay, that's called Kuhn loss. In other words, the sort of things, the sort of entities, the sort of issues that don't any longer figure prominently on the scientific research agenda once the paradigm shift takes place. Okay, so the whole point about the Kuhn picture of scientific revolutions, which doesn't make it a picture of unalloyed progress, is the fact that you got to lose some stuff in order to gain some stuff. And the stuff that you gain is seen as being worth more than the stuff that you've lost. So certain things that you aren't really able to talk about very much any longer, or aren't able to talk about very coherently, drop out. So with the revolution in physics in the early 20th century, the disposal of the concept of ether, right, a medium through which physical action occurs, right, that was very central to Newtonian physics, increasingly so over the course of the 18th and 19th century, and that disappears entirely. That doesn't mean the problems that it was meant to solve disappear with it, because there are various ways in which the concept of ether is trying to be revived today, but it gets put very much on the margins, is not central to what the research agenda is about, okay? So there is a kind of collective forgetting that takes place during scientific revolutions. And so this is a kind of an interesting issue that needs to be, in a sense needs to be discussed more openly, namely, there is on the one hand the value of the wisdom that comes from knowing and benefiting and acting on collective knowledge, the sort of wisdom component, you might say, of age, versus the kind of liberty, the freedom that you get from just junking stuff because it no longer seems relevant, it's causing more problems than it solves, from the standpoint of someone who's living now looking more toward the future than the past. Okay, so there's this kind of issue here, and the point that Kuhn raises, whatever one wants to do with it is nevertheless correct. Namely, there is a tendency for things to just be dropped, and often these issues that get dropped from the frontline scientific agenda get picked up by other fields, and of course, eventually, if not immediately, get picked up by historical fields. Okay, so, and in fact, within the history of science as a discipline these days, to give you a sense of how aware people are of this, there is now this whole movement to discuss what's called complementary science. Okay? Hsieh Chang, if I may... I'm talking about this, I don't necessarily endorse it, but I think it's an issue worth thinking about. Okay, so this is the guy who has the chair in history and philosophy of science at Cambridge these days. He's been putting forward this idea of complementary science. Namely, what the historian of science does is to revive the lost science, the stuff that people don't take seriously anymore, and try to figure out what it was about it that actually made some sense in its time. And in a sense, he you know, he suggests that a lot of the things that are often called pseudoscience now are, as it were, you know, like homeopathy and things of that kind might be included in this category. Okay, so there's this kind of collective issue about what happens when the stuff is forgotten collectively from the history of science. Where does it go, and what sort of status it has? Okay. But within the you know, I mentioned earlier I'm involved with the transhumanist stuff. Within transhumanism, there's a very funny kind of attitude toward all this, especially in light of the kinds of, because, you know, we've been thinking about aging and dying very much in terms of the confines of the human body as it's normally understood in biological terms. But of course, if you look at the more ambitious attempts, you know, there are on the, let me just draw attention to a distinction. There is, as it were, you might say, the less ambitious attempts to keep the human going forever. And that's the one where, you know, Aubrey de Grey, you may know about him, who believes that if we can switch certain genes on and off, we, in our physical human bodies, could potentially live for 1,000 years. Right, and that in a sense we're getting close to a point where we can actually engage in those kinds of manipulations. Now, the reason why I say he's the more conservative viewpoint is because he's still very much operating within the confines of the biological human body and basically trying to upgrade it or enhance it or something, but understanding that as the thing that needs to survive in order to live forever. Okay, so in other words, it's very much based on that biological body as the surviving entity through which the human is being identified. But that's not the only view, of course. And in fact, the view that I think gets even more attention these days is the one that's associated with Ray Kurzweil. And this is the whole idea that uploading our consciousness, including all of our memories, okay, including all of our memories, which is quite important to what I was saying before, right, into a machine that can exist and continue to have more memories in perpetuity. Okay? Now, this viewpoint, which Kurzweil, and you know, there's, you know, regardless of whether one thinks this kind of issue is likely to happen in the near future or not, the point is there's a lot of certainly advertising and research money. I mean, there's an enormous amount of effort being put in this direction. It's interesting from the standpoint of our issues here because it doesn't take aging as a liability from the standpoint of the memories. In fact, the memories are one of the things that you'd be wanting to preserve in the new medium, as well as the consciousness. But what you don't want to preserve is the dilapidated body in which those memories are being conveyed as you get older. Okay? So that gives you a kind of a different sort of view, where in a sense you're trying to have your cake and eat it too, right? That in a sense you can, you know, in a sense you live in a sort of timeless existence where nevertheless you can increase your memories. Okay? And I think this creates a whole different range of problems with regard to what the relationship between aging and dying is. Okay? Because there's no dying in this picture. But that's not the only view. I want to say a few things on behalf of dying. Okay? Because there's a sense in which the dying side of this transhumanist position hasn't really been articulated very much. How much more time do I have?
12
minutes. Okay. One of the things that I think, if you want to distinguish between somebody like Aubrey de Grey and Ray Kurzweil, is there's a clear distinction between these two guys as to where does the essence of the human lie. Okay? Aubrey de Grey clearly is still very much in the biological body, and that there's a sense in which you might say, you know, we have come through the evolutionary process, and now, unlike other creatures, we are able to somehow enhance ourselves in some way, and thereby be able to continue as biological creatures, but ones that don't deteriorate over time. That's the kind of idea. Ray Kurzweil, on the other hand, seems to think that the fact that we have come through all of this biological evolution is in a way a historical accident, right? And now that we're here, though, we can start taking more fundamental kind of decision about how do we actually perpetuate or propagate what it is to be human in the future, right? So in this respect, the biological origins of the human being is a contingency in the radical sense of being, in some sense, disposable, in principle at least. Maybe we don't have the technology that enables us to do it right this minute, but there is nothing, as it were, problematic about trying to have a project to do that. Because what matters about being human has to do with the memory, the consciousness, the rationality. It has to do with those things that may be more adequately conveyed in a different medium. So the carbon-based medium in which the human body has transmitted the human essence for all these millions of years may not be necessary. We may be able to upgrade to a totally different material stratum. Okay, now it seems to me that if one takes... Now, with Aubrey de Grey, it's quite clear there's a sort of fear of death thing or antipathy to death going on with him. And it's quite clear the constituency for what he talks about are basically, you know, the TED conference people, you know, about TED. We've got these TED conference people. They're all these kind of middle youth people like myself, perhaps, right, who are of a certain age where we think, God, there's got to be a way to live forever. Right? I don't want to get old. I don't want to die. Right? And I think Aubrey de Grey, to a large extent, responds to that constituency very strongly. But then there's this other way, the Kurzweil way, where in a sense, leaving the physical, biological body, what would be normally identified as death, is not such a bad idea if you can be resurrected in some other way. Okay? And this is kind of what the issue is, you know, namely, is that can we, as it were, map the brain in a sufficiently sophisticated fashion, right, to be able to capture all of the stuff that we think is really important about the way the brain operates and put it into some more durable medium where it can continue in that form forever, right? That possibility actually would allow for a certain kind of dying to occur and then a rebirth to occur. Okay, at least if you understand this whole process from a strictly biological standpoint. Okay, and it seems to me that the Kurzweil people take that kind of idea seriously. Now, one of the things that's kind of interesting here is what is the notion of the human that's involved with the Kurzweil idea? And it seems to me that, you know, that there is a sense in which there is a value being placed on quality experience, quality consciousness, right? In a sense, one doesn't want to lose. And so one wants to preserve that kind of thing indefinitely. But if that's the case, then, is there any intrinsic value in being in one's biological body for an enormous length of time? Cannot one have, as it were, quality consciousness, quality experience within a relatively short biological framework, okay, in terms of the amount of time you're in your biological body, you know, and then have that uploaded into some more durable medium. Okay? And I say this because I do think that if we take the Kurzweil possibility kind of seriously, right, then there's a sense in which we should, you know, we should be thinking about how long people should live and the circumstances under which they should die in terms of the quality of the lives that they're leading. Right, and there may be a moment where one might want to think about, okay, it's time for an upgrade, aka death, right? And this then does change the kind of normative complexion surrounding the notions of life and so forth. Okay, I'll stop after I make this point because I think there's enough here on the table for people to talk about. There was a famous movie in the 1970s, again, some of you ancient people may remember it, called Soylent Green. Okay. Well, Soylent Green, this was a movie, Charlton Heston was a star in the movie. It's a movie that is a dystopian New York, where, and you got to remember, in the late 60s, early 70s, again, you people who are too young to remember, the whole idea of the population explosion was such a big deal, right? You know, if we weren't going to be wiped out through nuclear war, it would be by having too many people around. You know, too few, too many. Either way, you have a problem with human beings. And the thing about this movie was, the punchline of the movie, in a way it spoils the whole plot to tell you this, but it's relevant. Namely, in the end, the population is living off of eating human beings, right? But in a kind of processed form. But the thing that's kind of interesting from the standpoint of the argument So it's this endless recycling of human beings. So if you're, you know, it's a kind of an interesting kind of parody of ecological thinking, perhaps. But the thing that's crucial from the standpoint of the point here was that people always had the option in this society of when they wanted to die, when they thought they weren't contributing and so forth, they could set up appointments to go into these things that were called departure lounges, like airports. As someone who spends a lot of time in airports, this resonates a lot, and if you remember the film, it actually does look kind of like an airport departure lounge, where you could actually see how your life was, right, before your eyes, before you're terminated and then turned into food, right? I mean, that's kind of what the process was. Now, the interesting thing, now I'm not saying that this is what we should go, but the aspect of thinking about what it is to have, as it were, a full life, you know, in the biological body, where it might be time to, as it were, transport or transmit those experiences, those consciousnesses into another form, where they may be able to be experienced by other people, right, or experienced in another kind of medium. You know, in other words, turn your life into a film, perhaps, that others can see and you get high ratings, right? That this can, in fact, be some kind of future sort of aspiration. Okay? And then this changes, it seems to me, the whole character of death, right? The finality of death. If you think about within the philosophical tradition, as we've been alluding to throughout this talk, right, the significance of death kind of, in a way, disappears, because there is a sense in which one continues to live, whether it be in other media, in some sort of silicon-based medium, or through the memories of others who are able to see your life on film, as it were, not just the people who are in the departure lounges, but everybody else can. And in that sense, you end up having a kind of eternal resurrection, in a sense. Okay? And I think if we take this kind of transhumanist notion seriously, this is assuming that we actually want all of these memories to be preserved, and that they're worth preserving and worth having reproduced, right, leads us in an interesting kind of direction. But the point that I want to raise earlier about the Kuhn law stuff was that from the standpoint of the history of science, forgetting is often seen as having had a very positive role in terms of motivating people to move in new directions. And so, as it were, not very easily having available a lot of old memories turns out to actually be empowering. So there is this issue of the importance of forgetting with regard to our notions of progress in the history of science, which Kuhn, in a sense, is drawing attention to, versus the possibility that if we're able to upload our experiences and consciousness into new media, where, in a sense, memories could be continued and fed upon forever in these other media. And with that, I will stop, because I think I was kind of hoping we might have moved a little bit more in this direction, but you know, where in a sense we sort of problematize a little bit more the biological body as the seat in which all this action of aging and dying is occurring. But I'll stop there and open up to discussion. Thank you. Yeah.
I loved listening to him, but I can't understand, and I have a student who's been working on transhumanism, so I'm not... I enjoyed it for lots of reasons, but I just can't understand the how you can talk in that way, in such a dualist way. I mean, how could you talk as if we were not our bodies?
Yeah, but the question is, what kind of bodies, right? I'm not saying that we can, in some sense, just evaporate. That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about the sense in which the human being is tied to the kind of carbon-based bodies that, as we generally believe now, to have been the product of so many billions of years of evolution. Is that, as it were, is that the only container in which we can exist as human beings? Okay? And it seems to me transhumanism is challenging that, at least Kurzweil's brand of it, is challenging that in a fundamental way. And I think people do resonate to that. And one doesn't have to be so crazy as Kurzweil, right? I mean, the fact that people are spending increasing amount of time, you know, interacting in cyberspace and inhabiting avatars through which they're getting what they regard as more meaningful experiences, it seems to me that there is already a kind of projection, not to some you know, non-space or non-matter, but as it were, moving across from one very clear material embodiment to perhaps multiply other ones. That's all I'm claiming.
Yeah, I can see that, but it seems to me really attractive in that way, and easy to respond to, you know, this feeling that I could be indeed elsewhere or in some other, you know, think of all those other films apart from that one.
Yeah.
And novels, you know, Welbeck or...
Sure, exactly,
Matrix, it's easy, I think it's easy to relate to, on the contrary, I think it's easy to think I might not be in my body. I just think it needs resisting because it seems to be far too ethereal.
But see, this is where, as it were, you might say the empirical challenge is to find the other medium, right? And look, at the end of the day, this is where I think, you know, sociological surveys of the future will show this, but if we have already been able to show that people are spending increasing amount of what they regard as quality time in the internet, often inhabiting avatars or assumed identities, okay? And if you were to push the issue further to say, well, if you had the opportunity to be able to continue your life in that form versus being able to continue in your physical form indefinitely, which would you choose? You see, I could start to see, you see what I'm saying? I could see a branching here going on. And I do think that those kinds of questions will be asked in the future.
This is Cronenberg existence.
Exactly, Cronenberg's existence, exactly, yes. Yes, David Cronenberg is actually very good on this point in general for the last 30 years. Yeah.
I don't know, whenever I've tried to read about those people, I mean, I really like sci-fi, seeing it's a speculative genre, but on the other hand, I don't think it can cross over to philosophical territory. You can ask a few things, but it never really takes me to answer. So, regarding Kurzweil, I always had the impression that instead of offering something really profound, he's asking something really common, nonsensical. Because, for instance, want to think about the different materializations, we can talk about Spinoza and his two attributes, and the fact that he said, okay, the body or extension is one attribute, there might be infinite other attributes which we don't know, so he leaves open the possibility, not of different materializations of the human, but in talking about extension, for instance, he would the framework, let's say, to not be confined to the biological. You said that, okay, that this project is good to have. But to me, unfortunately, I find this to be a very vulgar display of the amount of money spent on this research, which is based on completely naive and commonsensical views about the mind and the body. They are vulgarly dualist, they rarely inquire into this. And apart from them, I find that they're very, very much laden with patriarchal fantasies, capitalist fantasies, and it's really difficult to digest as something that's about to promote knowledge. Because I don't think they're interested in knowledge, I think they're interested in gadgets that work and that will sell well. So I don't think this is science. It's been so difficult for me to accept this. I mean, I'm open to any discussion, but it's so difficult for me to accept this as a science. And I find that whenever they cross disciplines, it's because they have nothing more to say in their own discipline. And more.
Well, okay. Lot to say here, but I mean, I think it is interesting that, you know, if you look at somebody like Kurzweil, his own background is he's one of these entrepreneurs of speech recognition technology.
But you said the right word, entrepreneur.
No, no,
it's full of marketing.
No. I'm not. Look. I'm not disagreeing with you on that point. Okay. I mean, the point is though that if we ruled out every kind of interesting idea because of capitalist associations, we wouldn't have much left. Okay.
No,
but I mean, look, first of all, what is different, let's say, from Spinoza, okay, you mentioned Spinoza, right, is that Kurzweil, and I think a lot of the people who are pushing this version of transhumanism are talking about individual survive. You know, in other words, they're not just talking about the fact that that we're part of some sort of larger cosmos or some kind of larger material area, but that somehow the personal individual consciousness can be preserved in a material form in its individuality without being in the biological body. Okay, so it's a different kind of metaphysics, you might say, that's operating here.
What does it mean? Is it a metaphysics?
Well, this is the thing. No.
I think
the issue here. I mean, I think what they ideally imagine, okay, when people talk about this, and I don't know if that's necessarily the best way to cash this out, but I think the way they normally talk about it is that somehow we'll be able to model the brain of an individual, right, and in some sense get a sense of how their neural wiring work and be able to, translate the structure of that into some other medium where it can continue functioning in the same way. I think that's the general view. I think that's a really difficult way of looking at the problem, because in a way it's as it were setting the benchmark much higher than traditional artificial intelligence. Okay, but I think that is kind of the thing they're talking about. So that if you want to say what is it of the biology that really interests these people, it's the brain, right? The brain is the thing that needs to be, as it were, kept along. And so, you know, in philosophy, we have this issue of the brain in the vat. Is the brain in the vat the same person as the one whose brain is in the human body? Well, they sort of believe, yeah, it would be, right? They have the same experiences, same consciousness, and so forth. So I think that's kind of what they're aiming for. I agree. I mean, the capitalist element should not be underestimated, but I do think that there is a sense in which it's just a general problem with transhumanism, right? In a sense, these are all, whether we're talking about Aubrey de Grey or Kurzweil and everything, in the first instance, the political emphasis is coming from a kind of libertarian view that in a way thinks that certain, you know, that we have technology available that would enable a certain elite group of people to pull away from everybody else and so forth. And so, yes, that's very problematic. And so when I engage in arguments about this and I think about this in terms of what the social justice implications are. You know, if we're going to allow one person to be able to download their consciousness successfully, then we better find some kind of state-provisioned way of allowing everybody to do it, okay? And so my view is not to prevent it, but to, in a way, socialize it, okay? That would be my view on that.
But if I may...
Sure, go ahead.
Obviously, talking about a different way of experimenting with stuff in general,
mm-hmm.
compared to, as I'm sure you know, as
yeah.
a professor of science. So you don't really start from an observation, from a discovery,
right.
which makes you wonder, and then you really need to experiment with it more and more and more in order to command the consensus
exactly.
of the scientific community. So you're not talking about the power of nature to silence opposition. But to prove something to the scientific community. But you're talking about, okay, I have a good idea. Let's say I have a hypothesis. Let's say that we can live in a different medium. Let's try to work this out. So it doesn't really work, at least up to this point, it doesn't really work as traditional experimental science.
Yeah, that's
because
right.
It's not about having something to work with.
Yeah.
It's trying to manufacture something.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. No. In fact, one of the things I would say is that that in a sense, the momentum for this kind of transhumanist stuff very much depends on a breakdown of canonical notions of scientific authority. Okay, where, like, you know, I just mentioned Kurzweil, though he has a PhD and, you know, and is very well educated and all the rest of it, no one's going to deny that, nevertheless is an entrepreneur who nevertheless is setting a certain kind of agenda, and a lot of the people who are involved in this are also in the same way. So there's a, as it were, a breaking down of the boundary between not only science and technology, but also, you know, science and welfare, science and whole sorts of other issues. But it seems to me that this, you know, in a sense, this is kind of the extreme end of a general development that's taken place with the rise of computer culture as a mainstay of the economy, Okay, so as we've moved into that sort of post-industrial political economy, right, however capitalist it is no longer based on the sort of classical notions of industry, but it's based on the computer stuff. This, all these blurrings have occurred. And in a sense, what I'm talking about is just, as it were, a very, you might say, metaphysically extreme version of something that's already here with us, right? And so, I'll give you a good example. The U.S. National Science Foundation, about 10 years ago, initiated this whole program of converging technologies, nano, bio, info, right? Okay, you know about this. Right, well, the thing that was very interesting about this was, part of the motivation was trying to find a justification for the pursuit of long-term, what we might call blue sky scientific research, in an era where science had become very much marketized, where the only kinds of scientific research being funded was stuff that was very much directly available to consumers, you know, like the pharmaceutical industry and so forth. But if we're talking about physicists and chemists and people who in a way traditionally operated in a more sort of basic research environment, then they needed a kind of longer term horizon within which to make their work justifiable. And in that context, this transhumanist stuff looks attractive. Okay, because in a world that's been marketized with regard to what scientific research is for, the idea, you know, of saying, well, we're not just trying to produce products that you'll be able to use tomorrow, but we're trying to produce, as it were, new human beings who may come on stream, you know, two or three generations from now, that then becomes the version of basic research that is fundable in a highly capitalistic, right, post-Cold War environment. And I see converging technologies very much in that vein. And if you look at the European equivalent, which the European Union put out and was a basis for several framework projects, the idea there is that we need this kind of enhanced workforce to minimize welfare provision. Right? We have too many people living too long. We can't provide the welfare support for them. We need them to be more productive for longer. So now we need our scientists to be working on that as well. And so on both sides, on both the US side and the European side, you get a kind of justification through this initiative for long-term, what would otherwise be called basic scientific research. But it is responding to the capitalist imperatives.
Granted. So what I'm saying, I'm stopping, is that instead of challenging established metaphysical positions, mm-hmm. I'm just saying that these fields are not metaphysical, they're simply trying to assume power in a field that was formerly not theirs. This is true.
I don't disagree with that point. I think its issue maybe is the normative import of this, but we don't disagree on the fact.
I wanted your view on it, because this whole hype about this university, so kind of in the 80s or something, you get the whole hype about the genes. I mean, I quite similarly might be. I mean, I remember it was, you know, similar, kind of movies on it. It was somehow almost inevitable that, you know, this will happen, but only dog will be things that are 10 years ago and I turns out that's not the case.
But that's only a time delay. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't think this is such a big... Sure, the Hollywood is ahead of the curve. That's the way I look at it. Hollywood's ahead of... It's not that the stuff never happens. It just happens longer after the time in which people are talking about it. And the thing is that people like Kurzweil are a little overambitious. And so it's easy to kind of, you know, poo-poo them and say they're talking crap. But if you, 100 years from now, I actually think that we, and with the genes thing, exactly the same thing. I think it's just that there's a sense in which the hype does outrun the reality, and that it's very easy to knock down the hype, and then people just get this blanket skepticism, but the stuff continues.
I understand your points now. It's very simple question. Maybe I understood not well what you said. What is the connection between what you said here and science or experimental science? And what is the connection between what you said here and the idea that maybe there is some rupture of paradigm or something like that. I couldn't understand this well. I precise. For me, what you say has nothing to do with science.
Really?
Nothing to do with a rupture
of
paradigm.
Okay, here's how I see it. Okay.
The second would be on the plant test, but maybe we can discuss this after.
Can I answer your first question before moving to the Planck thesis? So can we deal with both? On the first point, I think that the character of science is changing in our time in a very fundamental way, which all of this transhumanism stuff reflects. Namely, where are the experiments happening in science? It's going to be in the way people live their lives. Okay, and what I do see in the long term, if this transhumanism stuff really takes over, is you're going to see a breakdown of things like institutional review boards. Those things are going to, they're going to be, there's going to be a lot of pressure put on those things to disappear or become more liberal. Well, because if you're
science is theoretical.
But this is
where is your changing theory here? Where is it?
Yeah, but see, the thing you have... Okay, look, but you're assuming...
But you see, if I take quantum mechanics, I see there is a change.
Yeah, but you're assuming that science has to be discipline-led.
If I take molecular biology, I see...
Yeah, no, but look, but you're assuming... See, you're assuming kind of the Kuhn picture here, whereby the way in which science moves forward is through paradigms that are identified with disciplines which set their own problems independently of anything happening outside, okay? I'm saying this is really broken down a lot, okay? And it may have broken down in a, you might say, irrevocable way. So that now, in a sense, the difference between, let's say, a kind of theoretically driven scientific experiment done in a lab classically, and the difference between that and somebody, as it were, living a sort of life where they're trying out new treatments and so forth, that may disappear. So in a sense, people will be living experimentally. The experiments will be the experiments will be happening. But I do think this is, that's my sense. And I think it will be possible, if that happens, for actually science to claim credit. Because I think, in a sense, people like Kurzweil and these other transhumanists, one of the things they've done, I think, very well, is they've made science and scientific progress. They've enabled people to kind of relate to it in a way in which they think they can start to live scientifically. Okay? And that may mean actually doing very radical things in their lives. And that, I think, is a certain kind of scientific worldview triumphing. It's not one that necessarily benefits scientific disciplines. It doesn't necessarily benefit the paradigms of science. But it marks a kind of scientism.
Ah, yes. Nothing to do with science.
Yeah, but I do think it does mark a kind of a triumph of a certain kind of scientism, right? Which is appropriate to our time because scientific disciplines are very weak and they are in less and less of a position to call their own shots. Okay? I mean, who is determining where science progresses these days? It's the funding agencies. And increasingly, people have to turn to private funders because the public funders are either disappearing or they're merging with the private ones. And this, I think, is changing the whole character of the way in which science proceeds. Okay? And I think, so in this respect, we're very much in a kind of post-Kuhnian world. Right? It's no longer paradigms driving the way in which science works.
I understand.
You understand? Okay. Yeah, the question about the Planck. I mean, we can talk about the Planck stuff. That's cool. Okay.
If I can go out on a slight paradigm shift,
Sure, go ahead.
What this just reminded me of is, I just want to ask you, what would be the relation of transhumanists to what some more traditional theories on this question? For example, Plato's theory in the Symposium, in which, Eros is seen as kind of, one manifestation of Eros, if I remember correctly, is to drive mortal beings towards immortality. And then you have lower mortal beings who can just do it through reproduction. Humans can do it through reproduction or,
right.
Ultimately through scientific philosophical teaching of the youth. So there is this idea of your survival through your legacy.
That's right.
And I'm just wondering, would they think of that to be as too allegorical from the stuff they were doing? This has its own implication. We're talking about, are we talking about the survival of the consciousness or the survival of the body? But with Plato, we have this idea of, if you get rid of mortality, you get rid of desire. And
Yeah.
So just wondering, you know, do they relate to...
Yeah, no, I mean, I can't speak for Kurzweil's knowledge of the classics or history, philosophy, or anything, but certainly people who follow this stuff talk about the idea of technosis and the idea that in some sense, and this goes back to, you know, the sort of Christian heresy of Gnosticism in the early period, the idea that that part of what human beings are trying to do is to sort of reconnect with God, right, from whom they have fallen, and that the material body is seen as an obstacle, right? And that, that one, in a sense, is trying to always etherealize or ephemeralize or in some way. And so this is why what matters with regard to somebody like Kurzweil isn't just that the silicon stuff lasts longer than the carbon stuff, but it gives you more power. Right, it amplifies your powers, right? That's the promise, right? So it's not just that you're preserving the memories indefinitely and increasing them, but you in some sense can amplify your computational ability, you can amplify all these things that matter and become more godlike in the process. So I think there is, you know, Kurzweil himself is a Unitarian by the, you know, Unitarian in his upbringing, he claims, which means that there is a kind of an identification of the human with the God, okay, that's going on there. And I think that is very much part of kind of what motivates why the vision is exactly the way it is, because it isn't just simply about indefinite preservation, right? It's about a self-transcendence that enables you to actually do more once you're in this other medium. And so I would think, yes, that there is a kind of, you know, from Platonism, Neoplatonism, into the early Christian Gnosticism, and there's a book that's called Technosis, this term I just put out here, that came out about 15 years ago by a journalist who was covering the first stage of all this stuff, Eric Davis. And you might find that interesting because it goes into kind of the philosophical, theological backdrop to that. Yeah.
No, right? Okay, thank you. I'm gonna live forever.
Okay, thank you.